It is Tuesday, the 2nd of March, 2021. And the title we gave for this podcast was What They Don't Tell You About Death.
Yes, except some of the things that I say will probably come as no great surprise to a lot of people. But yes, it's not something we normally think about on a daily basis until it starts happening to us.
No, we don't.
And it's almost as if we're biologically programmed not to do that, because otherwise our lives would be just too depressing. So we are by nature optimists about it ever happening to us.
Oh, I'm a bit surprised. I mean, yes, by nature I would certainly agree we don't think it's going to happen to us.
Certainly children don't think like that.
No.
I mean, they think about death, but most children don't regard it as part of their future. I mean, intellectually, they may realise that it obviously is, but they behave as if it wasn't.
Yes. Indeed, most adults, I suppose. I mean, eventually you realise it's going to happen at some point. But...
Yes. And I think, actually, the they don't tell you bit is as much they don't listen. You know, the younger people don't listen. I maybe I'm just judging everybody by my standards, but it's there is so much information in the modern world that you pick out the bits that interest you, and the bits about how we're all going to die and it's not going to be much fun are bits we tend to push to one side because they're unpleasant and there's nothing we can do about it. So there's no point in immersing yourself in it until you have to.
Except we write wills, of course.
Yes.
So we do make that preparation.
Well, personally, I mean, let's get to the point. The reason that got us thinking about doing this was that I've just been diagnosed with lung cancer, stage 4, which is a polite way of saying you're going to have it until you die. And it's forced me to rethink a lot of things, but mostly just to think about things I hadn't been thinking about. I hadn't even concocted a will, for example, which was very remiss of me. But I'm having to do that now. So that's what got us thinking about these things. What about you? I mean, you've recently experienced being very close to elderly relatives of various kinds who've basically been dying. So you've got just as much experience of this as I have in a different way.
Yes. Well, I'm just trying to think what I can say. I mean, the process of dying is just crap.
Yes. But I think, well, one of the things that strikes me about what I'm going through at the moment is this incredible contrast, well, not incredible, but very big contrast between the bigness of the situation, the sort of dramaticness of what's happening, and the deluge of small trivia that has to be dealt with. Now, because I haven't yet died, but it's my death that's provoking this deluge of trivia, I'm having to deal with that deluge, or at least participate in the process. I've got friends who are helping me tremendously, but one in particular who's helping enormously. But I can't avoid it completely, and I wouldn't want to. It's the contrast between, on the one hand, you know, you're probably going to die of lung cancer in a few months' time, and if you're lucky, a few years' time. And on the other hand, oh, what the hell's the password for this website which is dealing with one of my little investments? I put all the information in correctly. It refuses to let me in. It won't tell me why. That sort of thing. It's the gap between the bigness of what's happening and this endless little, even if you're the one who's already died, your loved ones are going to have to deal with the question of what hymns to sing at the bloody funeral. I say bloody because it's an annoying question. You know, what does it matter? Oh, just sing a hymn, for God's sake. You know, who cares? And yet they have to deal with it.
Because I was very glad that my mother had organised that.
Yes,
that was,
yes.
You know, much to her credit.
Well, that's one of the things I'm being told right now, that I need to concoct, I think it's called a letter of wishes or something, or at any rate, I need to say what sort of funeral I want. And I keep thinking, but who am I to be telling these people how they should celebrate my life and bemoan my death if that's what they want to do? Can't they organize it? But of course, their attitude is, well, we want to do what he would have wanted.
Well,
so
we'd like to play music that you like.
Yes, yes.
You know, and then we have a eulogy. I mean, maybe we can have two eulogies or three eulogies.
Yeah.
Or someone will say nice things about you. We can do that ourselves. But in terms of your music, well, we're not quite so sure.
Yes, exactly. And you've got to be told these things, even if it's rather random and rather fictitious. Because I don't have much in the way of individual pieces of music that I'm obsessed with, but I certainly love classical music as a whole. But my obsessions vary from month to month. So how am I supposed to pick one for my funeral? I don't know. but the point is, if I just pick one that I don't hate, then that's one less piece of bullshit for them to wade through when they have to. You know, that's the point. Do it, even though it falsifies your musical taste a bit, because it's bound to. Do it so that you can spare the people tidying up after your death this question, at least. You know, they don't have to fret about whether you like Beethoven's Fourth Symphony or whatever.
Well, better that you falsify your musical taste than us.
Than that they get it completely wrong.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But it's the nature of what I'm being asked to do that I hadn't previously quite grasped. And the answer is to minimise the chaos for my dearest and loved ones who are going to be, as I say, cleaning up the mess after I'm gone.
Well, the good thing is you get the time.
Yes.
I mean, this is the thing. With my mother, we had the time. Mm. And just about every good thing you could have in a death, as far as deaths can be good, we had.
Yes.
And it's still awful, but then you realise just what it's like when someone just drops dead like that.
Yes.
Or it's a child, or you don't see the body.
Yes.
Something like that, which is...
I think death out of the blue is a quite distinct kind of event from what I'm going through. It's quite different. I mean, what I've had to put up with, it sounds like a very big transformation, but actually it's just a change of... It's just a speeding up of what was going to happen anyway. I mean, I've got to the age where... I'm in my 70s now. I've got to the age where I'd have to be stupid not to be expecting to die within at least 20 years or less. Well, now it's more like 20 months. So it's different, but it's not as different as you might think. And, of course, it is a wake-up call to get me to do the things that really matter to me. So, for example, right now, at this exact moment, I'm looking at a picture of Chris Tame, my erstwhile colleague, in the libertarian movement in the 1980s and 1990s. And without him, I would not have been the libertarian that I was, and to some degree still am. I just couldn't have done it because he was the one who basically assembled a great throng of people who thought along these lines. And that meant I had people I could go to work and publish things for and write for, which was the heart of what I did. And without him, I couldn't have done it. It would have been meaningless. I would have just been writing open letters to myself. And so before I lose the ability to do it, I want to make sure that my thanks go to the late Chris Tame. He died prematurely. He was one of these people who... He did die prematurely, but at least he got some warning. He died in his mid-50s. But... you know, I wanted to do that before it's actually the first big piece of writing I've done since I was diagnosed. The second. I did one that was quite, which was the sort of, here's the bad news and here's what I've learned from it. And perhaps worth talking about that a bit.
Oh, sorry, has this piece been published? Because I didn't think I've seen it.
It's about to be.
Right, okay.
I haven't yet published it. I'm nearly there. With any luck, by the time you do your little notes on this, it will have been published. It's that close. And that's an example of how, well, as people say, death concentrates the mind wonderfully if you get a chance to, you know, if you're given a certain amount of time before it happens.
Yeah, yep, that's true.
And of course, if you just get hit by a bus in the street at the age of 47, you don't get that moment of being allowed to concentrate on the serious stuff. But as I keep saying, as I was saying earlier, this wanting to think of, that's what the big stuff means to me. It's a series of public statements of things that I consider to be important, and don't want to die having failed to say, put it that way. But then again, I go back to it. You get deluged with trivia. You know, what piece of music shall be played at my funeral? Which honestly, I'm not that bothered about. But I realise I have to answer that question somehow, because if I don't, it'll create even more complications for my friends and relatives after I'm dead. So I thought I'd be able to publish this piece on Chris Tame about a month ago, but I just haven't been able to get round to it.
Oh, death is a
because of all the cleaning up and that phrase, putting your affairs in order. Given the state of my affairs when I was diagnosed, putting them in order is one hell of a task, and it's made it that I just couldn't quite manage to do the Chris Tame article as quickly as I would like to have done. I mean, I would have hoped to have been on to number 4 or 5 by now, but no, I'm still struggling to finish number 2.
Right.
Number 1, by the way, if you want to talk about that, was a piece I wrote not long after being diagnosed, which and had already begun to be treated for cancer at the Royal Marsden Hospital, which is near where I live, and it was about the contrast between how well the medical system in Britain treats you once it knows what's wrong. And I think it's an extreme case with cancer, because so much progress has recently been made in the treatment of cancer that they're really quite a happy, confident bunch of people, the ones dealing with cancer, because they know they're making headway and they're making progress and they're doing people a lot of favors that they couldn't have done even 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago. I mean, it's interesting to speculate how Chris Tame might have fared if the state of medicine at the time when he actually died had been the state of medicine now instead. He might have been kept alive for quite some time.
The danger of going off topic, if I remember correctly, was at the time regarded as an incurable cancer,
and it was
a rare cancer as well.
Yes. Well, I think he had a very similar... I'm beginning to think he had a very similar sort of cancer to me, which is it's not caused by lifestyle misbehavior. For example, I was diagnosed with lung cancer, and obviously the next question was, how many cigarettes a day do you smoke? Well, the answer was zero, and the only question in their minds was whether I was telling the truth. And as soon as they did some tests, they learned that it was indeed the kind of lung cancer that isn't common. It's not the one caused by heavy smoking or drinking, for that matter, which I also don't do much of. And, you know, temporarily they took my word for it. But once they'd done their tests, they believed me. And I suspect Chris Tame, who was famously among all his friends, concerned about his health, and he used to go jogging for vast distances. He was the director of FORREST, the Freedom Organization for the Right to Enjoy Smoking Tobacco, but he never smoked himself.
No.
He believed in the rights of smokers, but he did not believe in being a smoker himself, for all the usual reasons. So I think he and I both had a rather similar kind of cancer. And I was looking through one of the letters I got with a report of the diagnosis, and I noticed that bone cancer was in the list of things wrong with me. In other words, the cancer had spread to the bone, to the bones, which is what he died of. He died of bone cancer, I believe. So it may be that the tumour was somewhere different, but the effects were...
The effects were similar. Right,
I think so.
Okay.
I think what I would have suffered in the absence of the treatment I'm getting and any other treatment might have been much the same as what he had to die with. I was going to say live with, because he didn't. The first piece I wrote, the first big piece after being diagnosed, was about the extraordinary quality of the treatment I was getting, the speed, the technical excellence of it, as far as I can tell. from what I've read and what I've heard from talking with medically expert friends and relatives, and the kindness of everybody. I mean, it's always said that I had a picture of the NHS of rather brusque and slapdash human relations, shall we say, between the nurses and the patients. Not a bit of it. I mean, I've been very kindly treated.
Well, you're lucky.
I agree. I think you're right. I think I am.
I have seen some really awful relations. I mean, that sense of just, you know, the nurses think, why are these patients bothering me? That sort of thing. And the chaos that goes on in the NHS, I've seen that. But, I mean, although I have, that's with my mother. With another dying relative, it was fine. It was lovely. They were absolutely, glad to see her as she departed this mortal coil. I don't know why. I don't know how that is.
Well, I think I'm very glad I put in my piece about how well they treat you when they know what's wrong with you, that I might be biased because I'm at the Royal Marsden, which is a hospital. It's a hospital, first of all, which does nothing but cancer. And second, it has a worldwide reputation. It's one of the best cancer hospitals in the world, if not the best. I've heard people say that as well. So you're right. I think that the NHS is a lottery when it comes to treatment. It can be very good or very bad. That's the sort of hearsay verdict. But for me, it was very good. That's the point I'm getting at. Whereas the diagnosis, and again, maybe I'm going by my personal experience, which is bad, was, through no fault of the individuals concerned, an incredibly languid and relaxed process, given what the actual story turned out to be. You know, you can have maybe you should have a CT scan. Are you free at the end of next month? You know, that kind of thing. And after about 3 or 4 months of this, and all the people involved were very nice about it. They were just not very sure what was happening and weren't clear in their minds what my aches and pains might mean, if anything at all. And were they supposed to hurl large amounts of resources at checking me out? And if me, why not all these other people in the waiting room also with aches and pains and misfortunes to report? And maybe I was just one of these semi-malingerers. I just had a miserable, lonely life and I wanted a sympathetic conversation with a doctor. What if that was my real condition? So how do you, I mean, my sister, who is a retired NHS GP, general practitioner, explained it very well, that it's telling the difference between people who are just unhappy and have slightly creaky limbs or whatever it is, and people who've really got something wrong with them, of a kind which is both serious but also, you hope, treatable. And what happened was that I discussed this with some friends of mine, a married couple, and she is a very experienced nurse, and she listened to me babbling on about my discomforts of various kinds, and she said this should be looked into, and she gave me the name of a private sector GP. I rang him, I gave him the story. He said, well, I'm not the person to deal with this, but I know the man who is, and he sent me there, and it felt like within about a week I'd gone from, oh, there's something wrong here, I wish I knew what it was, to, right, now we know. And in no time at all, seemingly, I was actually being treated at the Royal Marsden, because one of the features of my particular condition was that my spine was quite close to the action, as it were, and needed to be protected with some targeted radiotherapy. And that's what happened. And I was going in there every day for a week, I think, over Christmas. You know, none of this, everything stops for a week over Christmas. I was getting, first-rate treatment from an elaborate machine, which looked like something out of a science fiction movie, at considerable expense, presumably. There was no interruption for Christmas. They got right on with it. And then a few weeks later, they'd finished their testing and satisfied themselves what sort of cancer I had, and now I'm having the treatment. But the process of finding out about it, if I'd left that to the NHS, I'd be just about dead by now, I think. That's the feeling I have about it. My guesses about medicine are only guesses, but I think I'd have been in a very bad way.
Yeah, I think that's my experience. Something very odd happened last summer, because I had shingles, or what turned out to be shingles, and it was impossible to get to see a GP. Impossible.
Even to get to see one?
Yeah. I say impossible. No. If you rang up at 8:30 in the morning and you happened to get in with, 100 other people trying at the same time.
Yes.
And you might get through, but if you dialed after 9 o'clock, no chance.
Yes.
Extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary system. And this is a surgery which is normally very good over the years. That was a bit of a shocker. I had to go private in the end.
Is that something to do with COVID?
It may well do. It may well do.
Yes.
I think that has deranged
NHS. My advice to somebody you yourself know if you're malingering, if you want a friendly conversation with a doctor or you've really got something wrong with you, you know whether that's which of those two things is going on in what combination. And if you know that there's something wrong with you and you're not somebody who normally complains about these things, I would advise you to investigate the private sector, general practitioner, the general practitioner bit, i.e. the diagnosis bit, because the speed with which they went into action for me was an extremely refreshing contrast.
Yeah. I went through one of these online GP services, and well, actually, it seemed quite slow to me at the time. But in retrospect, yeah, that was a lot quicker than the alternatives would have been, shall we say?
Yes.
And I was very glad I did, even though it was quite expensive.
Mm.
And even though I'm not sure it did an awful lot of good, but at least I knew what I had.
Yes.
Well,
of course, it could well be the answer will come back. You're all right. You've had a bang or something a few years ago, and it's come back to cause you some aches and pains or something like that. Mm. That actually was what I thought might be what was happening to me. No such luck. excuse me, I'm coughing a little bit.
We're trying to get back to the topic, I suppose.
Yes.
We're talking about NHS diagnosis, which is not quite the same thing as death itself.
It's an important part of my personal recollections of all this.
Yeah.
That to me, it seems like an important point worth making. And there's a blog posting I did for Samizdat that you can link to from the notes, I hope, where I tell that story.
I thought you did it on your personal blog. Maybe you did it on Samizdat.
My personal blog, I concentrated on the fact of my diagnosis, but I also talked at length about what people could do to cheer me up, which was say nice things about me. In other words, I would like to hear the funeral eulogies, please.
Yes.
That was what I basically said to all my friends and relatives. And I got some quite good responses.
Deservedly so, I'm sure.
Well, the best one
I'm
of
sure,
all,
anyway.
Apart from managing to do some more of these with you, which is very nice, but that was happening anyway. But the best one of all was what Rob Fisher started doing, which is gathering together an archive of my best writings. The problem with my life as a writer is that there are quite a lot of good bits and pieces buried in among an absolute deluge of trivia, of stuff that are of no great consequence to most people. I mean, I hope there are some people who will want to read some of my more esoteric observations about life. But as far as a wider audience is concerned, that audience is going to be libertarians, and my best bits, as far as they're concerned, are going to be the explications of libertarian ideas that I did mostly during the time when I was collaborating with Chris Tame. And then since then, I've probably done about a dozen quite good postings for Samizdat in among the many dozens of postings I've done for Samizdat, which will die the death. Deservedly, because they're of no great consequence. But that's not things you don't, they don't tell you about death. I'm sorry, I'm departing from the agenda, if that's what the agenda is. But I think the general point that I've talked at length about what I mean by the big stuff and what concentrating on the big stuff has meant for me personally. And somebody listening, please don't sort of feel you have to care about libertarianism if you don't. But Mike, what I would ask them to think about is what they do care about. Try to sort of use that as what I've been saying about libertarianism. Well, what do you care about? Is it your family? Is it your is it something you want to say? Some religious thing? Who knows? That's what you've got in your mind as a result of what's happening to you. And you've probably got a whole mass of details. Again, the details won't be the same as my details, but there'll be plenty of them. Maybe relatives all ringing up and saying, you know, what should we do? And you have to think about that, and it's difficult. And some of them are slightly awkward. It might be something like that. But I think this contrast between the big stuff and the small stuff is, I suspect, something that happens a lot to a lot of people when, in one way or another, their death is being confronted, either by them, because they've been told about it beforehand, like me, or by their nearest and dearest after they've died suddenly. Those people then have to deal with the fact that they've lost somebody, and that's a big deal. And what should the coffin be made of? You know, that kind of question. Oh, God, I don't know. Did she ever say what she wanted? I think she
may
have.
It turns out, actually, almost everyone goes for the cheapest option. Yes. So that's fine. That's fine. Yeah. You don't have to get excited about that one.
Well, I'm just trying to grasp a principle that, you know, what are we going to do about his allotment? You know, those sort of questions.
To which the answer, in I think a vast majority of cases, it just goes. Things get thrown away.
Yes, yes.
That was an eye-opener because, you know, the number of conversations I had with my sister. Well, what should we do with this? It's really nice. Well, I don't have the space. Do you have the space? No, I don't. Right, we'll throw it away.
Mm.
You know, we just didn't have the time. We could have just, you know, invited all our friends around to take what they liked. But that's problematic if there are things you already have bagseed. And also there's a question of when you do that, because you don't really want to do it before you sold the house, if there's a house involved. There's just huge amounts. Just got. I mean, it was a real shame because we like to think our mother was quite the interior decorator, and that house just got completely broken up. Everything got thrown away.
Yes. Then you get a sense of guilt about all this, don't you?
I got there were worse senses of guilt than I think I had.
You tell yourself you wish you had didn't, have, but you tell yourself you did have to do that actually.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
No. But I'm sure some people.
Although I would say, if you want to avoid guilt, especially with old relatives, make sure you phone them up on a regular basis.
Yeah,
that will expunge a lot when the time comes.
That's true. Yes.
And I was very glad I did that.
What other things? Well. To me, I'll tell you another weird contrast I'm experiencing at the moment, if you don't mind me saying some more. On the one hand, the longish term prognosis for what I've got is not good, and it's remained not good. And the evidence for that I personally have is that when I ask them about that, they either tell me something pessimistic or they change the subject.
This is doctors changing the subject.
Well, evading the question and talking about something else. But usually they're quite... I mean, I remember once when I asked a doctor, the first big consultation I had at the Marsden, this was after they'd started treating me and before they began to work out exactly what kind of cancer it was. Because when I had the first examination, they could see there was a problem, but... They weren't exactly clear what kind of cancer was causing it, but they could see what the problem was and what to do about it. So they started straight away. But when I went to the Marsden and had the first big consultation and met the man in charge and all that and all the team of people, I remember asking one of the doctors at a certain point, knowing what you know about
my
situation.
So when you say a team of people, do you mean there were more
than
one
doctor? Well,
there were
about half a dozen different doctors taking in turns to talk to me.
Oh, wow.
And I'm still trying to work out exactly who's who and what their names are. I mean, I can remember the name of the...
Oh, here, top tip. When you're dealing with doctors, take along your phone and record the conversation.
Well, I did that. But,
oh, right. Okay, you did. Right.
I didn't find that hugely helpful, actually.
Ah, okay.
Because the question was then, would I listen to it? And I didn't listen to it as often as I should have. And actually, I don't think the conversations were the only point. I mean, I really would have needed a video of all the people so I could remember names and faces. It turned out that's what I wanted to remember. But what I'm saying is this, that I asked one of the doctors this question. Knowing what you know now about my state, how long would you guess, and I emphasize that word, I've got? And the point I'm getting at is, of course it's only a guess because it's just an average. But what is the average, in your opinion, that I'm looking at? I'm not going to hold you to it. I'm not going to get angry if I live longer than you say or die sooner. I get it. But what's the answer? And the answer was 1 year. That was the guess I managed to get out of them.
Right.
Well, not long after that, when the treatment began, and that is to say, after they knew more about the kind of cancer I had, I heard one of them say, make the guess, 18 months.
Well, that's nice.
So, and that hasn't changed. Well, it's nice. I mean, that's actually quite funny to hear you say that, you know. It's nice that it's gone up by 6 months, but I would much prefer that it had gone up by 10 years, if you see what I mean.
Well, yes.
But it certainly hasn't done that. And in other words, the situation is approximately as bad as it was when I was first told about it, all this. However, and we're now coming to the good news, the treatment I'm getting in the short run is borderline miraculous. I mean, I talk about the magic pills I'm taking on my personal blog, because that's what it feels like.
You sound so different. I mean,
yes.
I think about what it was like in January,
yes.
And you were coughing all the time and feeling pretty rotten.
Absolutely.
And the difference is amazing, to the extent that it's quite difficult to believe that your things are getting worse.
I know. And it's a weird contrast. On the one hand, I've got spectacularly better. And on the other hand, I've still got stage 4 lung cancer, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a very odd sort of limbo to be living in. Very strange. And I wonder if other people recognise that strange mixture of feelings that I now have.
I find that difficult to relate to, because in my mother's case, it was, you know, you got 8 weeks.
The news was bad and it stayed bad all along,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And by the way, it was exactly 8 weeks from the diagnosis to,
yes,
to death. So,
yes.
Well,
I'm discovering that doctors, when they do give exact predictions, they're usually very confident about them. I was told to the nearest day when the pills they gave me, I take one of them a day, and they're targeted anti-cancer pills, something to do with the DNA of the cancer cells, which this drug can actually go straight to. So you get far fewer side effects than you got with traditional cancer treatments, you know, radiotherapy and all this, and chemotherapy. That's the really horrible one, isn't it?
Yeah.
And your hair falls out and you become, you know, very, very old.
Yeah.
Very quickly. Well, I'm not having to put up with that. I've got a few side effects. In my legs are a bit swollen, and there are other more unmentionable things happening. But they're not too bad. And on the whole, if I'm only allowed to say one thing about my treatment, I would say spectacular, in a good way.
Yeah.
As you've said, you know. And you're not the only friend who's commented in that way. All my friends agree, you know. God, look at you, Brian. You know, where was this a month ago? That's what they've all said. It's a bizarre experience.
Yeah. Well, it's made this podcast possible.
Yes. Oh, it is. It couldn't happen a month and a half ago. Forget it. Couldn't have been done. I might as well name the drug in question. It's called Ozymertinib, that's it.
Ozymertinib.
Drugs are like racehorses. All the normal, sensible names have been used up years ago, and they have to invent these bizarre monikers for them now, which is very... And you get these weird names. I don't know why it's called that, but it is. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
They're all based on genetic...
Well,
studies.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, you're saying it goes for the DNA, or acts
so.
On the DNA.
That's my understanding.
In some
they're operating at the genetic level.
That's wow.
And there was one moment that part of the diagnosis of my condition involved sending blood samples off to America, where this is being investigated. And it could happen more cheaply if I gave my permission for my blood to be used as part of their surveys and, you know, research, which of course I was very happy to say yes, go ahead.
Wow.
In that particularly odd way, I was lucky. You know, when people lose a leg in a car accident, people say you were lucky. Well, in that sort of way, I've been very, very lucky indeed. One, I live within the range of the Royal Marsden, as we've already discussed, and two, the Royal Marsden is on particularly good form at the moment in terms of the treatments it's learning how to offer and being able to offer compared to last year or the year before.
Does this show the superiority of the socialist system?
No, it's a mixed economy enterprise. One of the more striking things in the Royal Marsden, most of it's generic hospital, but there's one little place where there are two things that are very particular. One is the grand piano. Now, what's that doing in a hospital? I think it's probably some kind of fundraising social event place, you know,
mm-hmm.
where friends of the hospital come, listen to somebody playing Mozart piano sonatas or Chopin or something, and leave a check for quite a lot before they leave. And also in this same place, there is a big wall covered in the names of charitable enterprises. I tried to photograph it, but it's very hard to photograph that thing. But it's lots of sort of foundations named after elderly people, you know. And it makes it clear that the Marsden has an enormous influx of charitable money, probably from grateful patients as
Brian,
much as anything else.
Didn't you, when many, many years ago, write a piece, we must get it onto the archive,
yes.
Criticising charities?
Charity. Yes. Yes. Well, I just thought that was a case that ought to be made, because people are so coy about denouncing charity as being inefficient and often harmful. I think it often is. I thought it's time somebody said that. So it's the case against charity, but it's not the proof that charity should never happen, that piece of writing. And I do sort of retract a bit at the very end. It's a piece of advocacy rather than a judgment. Let me put it like that.
Yes, okay, yes.
Charity is misguided and harmful and shouldn't happen. But because some charity is good and some charity is spectacular in its goodness, people were reluctant to say charity is a very flawed principle. But it is very flawed, because the further away the people are from the decision about spending money, the less well the money will be spent.
Yeah.
You know. But the good thing about the sort of money that goes into the Royal Marsden is that you suspect that most of the people have had a quite good experience directly with the Royal Marsden. You know, they've been very well treated, or in some cases cured.
Less of a charity, more of an endowment, might be a better way of.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. It's partly charity, but it's partly people saying thank you with their checkbooks. You know, checkbooks are things that used to happen in the last century. I don't know if anybody listening knows what a checkbook is, but the point is, to answer the original question, the Marsden has an enormous wall of money that it does not get from the government. And this gives it a kind of independence that I think your average run-of-the-mill NHS trust somewhere in England doesn't really have. And so it's not quite right to call it state activity. It's a very independent, and it has a lot of clout as an independent organisation, the Marsden. That's the feeling you get. And that's what I hear from people who know more about these things than I do. You know, that nurse, for example, all the medical people I've talked to said, oh, yes, that's a hell of a hospital. You're very lucky to be going there.
Yeah, I think there are probably other examples in the state sector where bits of it sort of have more clout than others.
I'm sure there are.
I'm thinking particularly of Oxford and Cambridge, I suspect.
Yes.
Able to do this sort of thing. There may be other examples, I'm not sure. I'm thinking of that school that Tony Blair sent his children to, the London Oratory.
Yes.
It almost sounded like a nomenclatura school.
Yes. I think in general, we libertarians, if I can put it like this, are often full of praise for the varieties of institutions that can arise in a free society, and we celebrate all these variations which suit all the various tastes people have in how to work and what sort of things they want to buy, what sort of services they want. We're very good at that, but we're very bad at understanding the subtleties of state power and the complexities of state power. I think that would be less true of somebody like you, because you studied the military a lot, and the difference between, say, how armies work and how, you know, welfare ministries work and the Home Office and the, you know, all the, you understand that the army is a distinct enterprise with very particular ways of doing things that are not at all like other parts of the state apparatus. Somebody like you would understand that very well. But I think libertarians in general almost make a point of saying it's all the state, it's all very bad, it should all stop. Well, my point about the contrast I experienced between diagnosis and treatment is me trying to do some justice to the subtleties of state activity. Some of them can be good and others not nearly so good, relatively good. I mean, my favourite one is weather forecasts. Short-term weather forecasts, which are both state-funded and outstandingly good. I mean, outstandingly good. You're a fool if you don't take them seriously, if you need to.
Nice.
And yet they're
yeah.
provided by the ministry of whatever it is. I can't remember what the ministry is, but it's the Met Office. I mean, in their short-term forecasts of what the weather's going to be like in the next 48 to 72 hours are superb. I know this because I spent the last 20 years wandering around London taking photographs, and the weather is a very important variable to me because the good weather results in far better photos than bad weather for me, because I'm a pretty bad photographer. So I've had plenty of experience of looking at the weather forecasts and deciding that in 2 days' time I'm going to make a day of it because it's going to be really good weather. And every time the forecast was absolutely correct. And that's an example of state action at its most effective. Now, I don't know what the cost of all this is. I don't want to say that these forecasts come cheap and that they couldn't come a lot cheaper if they were done in the private sector and so on, or with much more private involvement. But I can tell you that these forecasts are very accurate.
I wonder how much this has to do with the military, because the military needs to know what the weather is,
what
it's going to be.
Yes.
It might be why the Royal Ordnance survey maps tend to be regarded as being very good, because, again, the military, Ordnance, by the way, the military needs to know what these things, what the terrain is going to be like.
Yes.
It might have something to do with that. Although I seem to remember someone did actually, and this is maybe 30 years ago, someone did write an article in a Sunday paper saying, I looked at 30 days' worth of weather forecasts and only 10 were right, or something like that. So
I think it varies. I think it depends what kind of weather forecast you want. If you want an exact prediction of when to the nearest hour it will rain, I think sports fans get very frustrated by cricket fans particularly, because it's so dependent on the weather. Cricket fans are infuriated by how if you're told there's going to be sunny patches and bright and scattered showers, that's not enough. When are the showers going to be scattered, and are they going to be scattered at the Oval? is the question that the cricket fans are all queuing up to ask, and they don't get an exact answer to that. But my question with my photography was, what sort of day is it going to be in London? And I always got the answer I wanted, and it was always accurate. So I think a lot depends on how accurate you are desperate for it to be. Because I can imagine this man saying 10 times out of 30. What he means by that is they got the timing of the rain wrong.
Well, I mean, they don't even do that. Do they do that? I mean, usually it's just they just give you a percentage chance of it.
Yeah, I know. Really. And they're very wise. That's because there are limits to what they know.
Yeah.
I mean, we're straying from the point, but to remind everyone, we're talking about the complexities of state activity, which started with healthcare and, of course, applies to all sorts of other things. That's the relevance of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Not sure we're ever going to resolve anything, but, well, yes, it's...
Well, it's interesting.
It's interesting, it's interesting.
You start with the truth, and what you do about it is... You may not have anything you can do about it, but at least you can face the truth as it is. And propagandists who go around saying things that regular people just don't think are true fail at the first fence, don't they? Because they lose their audience.
Right. Probably, I don't know. Yeah, it's probably true.
Well, they lose some anyway.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of a libertarian propagandists who I don't like and I find...
Well, the ones I don't like are the ones who don't tend to write so much. They're the ones who haven't been subjected to the kind of feedback that they would have been if they'd written this stuff down. I don't dislike most libertarian writers. I put that the wrong way. I don't know many libertarian writers who I think are badly wrong, but I constantly, in libertarian social circles, come across the occasional person who strikes me as very wrong-headed.
And they're wrong-headed because they don't write enough.
Yeah, they don't expose their opinions to the comeback that would cause them to change their minds, quite frankly.
Right.
But occasionally you come across... I think social media have sort of opened a window to this kind of thinking. And I often find people who talk... Governments, they say, always lie. No, they don't. They sometimes do, but they don't always lie. It's not true. I actually think the average business that you're dealing with is just as likely to be badly wrong for you as the government is. The argument for business is not that all businesses are better than all governments. It is that businesses get better and the bad ones disappear, or they learn to mend their ways and copy the good ones or get taken over by the good ones. It's the direction in which things move that makes the... And you get more things are attempted, but often done very badly by businessmen. You know, you're often screwed around by free people, you know.
Is that true? Yeah, probably. It was certainly a revelation to me to realise that actually there are bad businesses out there, and that's an important thing for libertarians to recognise.
Yeah.
We are not supporters of individual businesses. We are supporters of the free market.
Yes.
Because that is superior. But, there are plenty of rubbish businesses out there.
Yeah. Just rubbish in the sense that they sell bad products. Rubbish in the sense that they deceive you and tell lies and muck you around in all kinds of ways. I've just had a bad experience with somebody who wasn't a state functionary at all. Don't want to go into the details.
Well, I had a bad experience this morning. I'm quite happy to go into the details. There's a very small and rather cheap component of my car that broke recently. Can I get this by mail order? I can only get it from the manufacturer, Mercedes, by the way. It turns out the only way I can get this component is by going to their parts department. That's a journey. I cycle as it happens. That took me 45 minutes. So it's 45 minutes there, 45 minutes back. And why can't this be done by mail order? Well, it can't. Who knows why? You know, this is, you know, it's 20 years out of date, these people. And Mercedes has a certain reputation for customer service in all sorts of ways. I mean, it doesn't matter if you want your car serviced to get a part, or even for them to sell you a car. You sort of keyed on that. their reputation is dreadful, but Mercedes is not going to go bust tomorrow.
By the way, another link you might care to put into your notes on this podcast is a piece I wrote about Samsung, who a few years back, they went through a period of having overheating screens. I was looking to buy a new computer screen, and I discovered that Samsung screens were overheating near where the power comes in. You couldn't put your hand. It was too hot to touch. And I checked several different Samsung screens, several versions of the exact same model, and they were all behaving like this. And I wrote an article for Samizdata pointing this out. But I then went on to say, why do people complain about capitalism? The answer is because if you do, there's every chance you'll be able to have an impact. And it's fun. And above all, you can, because you're not dependent upon any one business. I didn't have to buy a Samsung screen, so I could rubbish their whole enterprise and still have a very good computer screen, which is the one I'm looking at right now. It's excellent. Done by somebody else. Who is it? I think it may be LG, but I'm not sure. But it's a very good screen.
Bearing in mind what you recently said about acronyms, we should point out that LG stands for Lucky Gold Star.
Does it?
Oh, did you know that? Yeah,
no, I didn't know what it stood for.
I think
for.
It does. Anyway, yeah, pretty sure it does.
But one of the reasons we don't complain about government enterprises is because if we do, we could antagonize the only people who might be in a position to help us. I think that probably distorts how people feel about medical treatment. Because I'm basically at the mercy of these doctors. If they make a mistake, I die. If they treat me well, I have several months, even years of life ahead of me. It's up to them. I don't know what they should be doing. I cannot judge the quality of the absolute essence of the product they're offering me. I don't know whether it's good or terrible. All I can go on is rumors and hearsay. I can tell you that they're very nice. I can tell you that they're very kind and thoughtful. And when I was in a bad way over Christmas, one of the big problems I had was getting off these beds they would put me on to test me. That was a hell of an ordeal. And what made it especially awful was that if they tried to help me, that made it even worse. So they had to just wait patiently while I got off this bed. It was a real test of their goodwill, and they passed it impeccably. They were immensely patient and kind about all this. In terms of the incidentals, I can tell you that the Marsden is superlative. I mean, for another example, the Marsdens are like a rabbit warren inside. You don't know where you are if you're not familiar with the place. Whenever I'm wandering around the Marsden trying to get from one place to another, which I often am, I'm constantly asking people with badges on, can you tell me how to get to the pharmacy? Can you tell me how to get back to the front door? Can you tell me where the oncology department is, or whatever it is. I've never had a bad experience there with one of these people saying, look, I'm just too busy, sorry, I can't help you. I've always had a very helpful answer from these people, which is all very nice. But if you ask me to guess whether the treatment is good and how good it is and whether any mistakes are being made, my guess is worthless. It's only a guess. And that's one of the basic problems with medicine, isn't it? You deep down, the patients don't know the quality of what they're getting.
Well, it's true of a lot of things, isn't it?
I suppose.
You mentioned computer screens before. I mean, unless you had known that Samsung had this problem, well, you wouldn't have known it had that particular.
Well, I found it out. I'd heard that they had problems with their mobile phone screens, also overheating. But I didn't know it afflicted their screens. I mean, the first one I had, it was overheating, and I took it back. And I said, give me another one. They gave me another one. That overheated. I took it back and said, I want my money back. I'm not going to buy one of these screens. So I did find it out eventually. I don't know why it was overheating. I don't know what mistakes had been made that caused this to happen. But I knew that it was. I knew there was something wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas...
But if you hadn't heard that...
If and when the time comes when my body starts seriously malfunctioning, I'm not going to know whether they could have done better in treating me or whether they did the absolute best they could possibly do in the light of current knowledge. I'm hoping it's the second, but I really don't know. It's all done on hearsay and reputation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like, at least a computer screen, you can look at it and see if it does what you want it to do. With hi-fi systems, you know, may not know all the details, but you can at least listen to it and say, well, yes, that's what I want it to sound like. And you can compare one computer screen with another computer screen, and the feeling is directly comparable. But I'm in a much less good position to compare how I'm feeling at any particular moment with how some other person just might be feeling in another hospital. I have to just hope for the best. And I think this distorts public discussions of healthcare. People like me want to believe the best of the treatment they're getting and have no way of being objective about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's true of... perhaps isn't true of items you buy in the shop, but, for instance, car repair. There's a certain amount of, getting the builders in. You know, lots of things can be hidden for quite a long time.
Yes,
by poor practicing.
You're right about that. Mm. Yes, that cladding disaster.
Yes. Or the fact my landlord had to have his roof redone recently because the original builders had done it badly.
Yes.
These things happen.
But in the case of builders misbehaving, people don't seem to have any problem pointing it out. I mean, we even have a special word to describe such people, cowboys. I've never heard doctors described as cowboys, even though some of them probably are.
Well, I suppose there's the fact that there's regulation. I know we are against regulation, but it probably
does... Well, I'm in favour of regulation done by people seeking to establish a reputation for themselves in a free market.
Yes.
That's why you have regulation evolving in a free society. It's because of these sorts of problems where, you know, if you just don't know whether your roof is going to be correctly mended, you want some kind of, you know, initials after the bloke's name to tell you that it is going to be done right.
This reminds me of an article you wrote some time ago all about the importance of repeat business. Or was it a talk you gave about repeat business?
Could have been.
I think the point was that, yeah, there's a huge difference between how people behave if they think they're going to get further business from you.
Yes. And it's in the nature of what I'm going through that this is the sort of thing that happens once. You know, you don't constantly get cancer. Well, I suppose you do, but it's not. It's the same cancer every time. What I mean, you know what I mean. You don't constantly have what I'm having.
Well, I suppose it does beg the question, what are their incentives here? Why should they do a good job with you?
I think partly is they just want to be nice. I mean, I don't think I never thought I'd be discussing these sorts of articles I've written for Sam Estarda, but I did one recently about how the proportion of people who don't have to put up with crap at work was the basic idea has gone up recently. It was a variation on the theme. I think I talked about this in connection with the Industrial Revolution. How many people can afford to stay alive for a month without the job they've got? And how many people can afford to be unemployed for a month without starving to death? It's a very interesting question you can ask about any society, any world. And I suspect that number has gone up a lot lately. Now, what that means is, and another way of putting the same thing, is that many more people have much greater choice in the kind of work they do. And I get the feeling that all the people in the Marsden are people who, yes, they wanted to make a living, but so long as they made a living, what they wanted to do was to make a living being nice to people rather than being nasty to them. And I think one of the reasons why the medical profession are so nice is that, quite simply, these people want to be nice. They want to be kind. And one of the advantages of people with serious illnesses is that you know that they need niceness. They really need it. There can't be any pretense. You can't fake lung cancer. You know, when you're nice to random people, you never know whether you're being taken advantage of. Well, am I taking advantage of them at the Marsden? Yes, I am, in the sense that I'm very glad they're looking after me. But there's a basic sense in which they can, A, be nice to me, and B, be confident that that's a good thing to do, and that their niceness isn't going to be wasted or exploited by me in a bad way. Does that make sense?
Perhaps because you're not in a position to...
Oh, I'm not, no. But I remember once starting to make a joke. One of my favourite jokes is, all the trouble in the world is caused by people trying to help. And then I realised, zip it, Brian, these people are trying to help. Don't say this, it's insulting. Because they were trying to help, and what's more, they were succeeding. As far as from where I was lying, they were being very kind to me. And the last thing I should do would be to sneer at them for this.
Well, you haven't suggested that it's their reputation on the line, or perhaps their reputation is partly on the line, but it might be helped.
Surely it's partly that, yes. Yeah. Oh, undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. Those charitable donations are not going to keep coming in if they snap at dying billionaires, you know, and treat them badly, are they?
Oh, right.
And I imagine that one of their sort of little private jokes is, you never know how rich these people are, you know? I'm guessing. Why not? After all, I dress like a tramp, and I've been counting my money recently, and it's more than I thought, you know.
Well, it was the old joke that, you know, rich people don't have to dress neatly. That's right.
It took me a while. I remember when I first began to work this out, when I had a boss who usually dressed very badly. But one day he came into the place of work we shared, and he was dressed like he was going to a royal wedding. And I said, what's that about? And one of the other people said, oh, he's going to the bank to try and borrow some more money. Uh-huh. So that's your point, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is all much more cheerful than I was expecting, this conversation.
Well, mainly because we haven't talked about death very much.
No, we haven't. I suppose, what have we talked about? All kinds of things. We've flown off at tangents.
Yeah, because we wanted to, because it's such an unpleasant subject.
Well,
I would guess.
One of my, not New Year resolutions, but lung cancer resolutions, if you see what I mean. It's as if you suddenly try to be a better person. One of mine is to stop asking people questions and then immediately interrupting the answer once it starts. So my question to you is, what do you want to say about death? And I promise to shut up and listen.
Right, okay. Well, I have a little list here. Grieving. I was going to talk a little bit about grieving. The first thing to say is I was very surprised to find out that not everyone has had to grieve, because a lot of people, I think it's true of you, find that their parents die at a very great age, and by the time they do, you've got all your grieving done, because you've seen that you've essentially lost them well before they actually die.
And even the process of losing them doesn't have that frightful quality that something like losing one of your children has, for example. You know, it shouldn't happen, is the feeling you have. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you, as I swore I wouldn't. But both my parents died when they should have died, you know. And I didn't feel any grief even when it became clear they were dying. It was kind of a natural process.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. Lots of people don't grieve in a big way.
I mean, the next thing I was going to say a little bit about grieving is that, I mean, there's this rather trite thing that occasionally gets recycled on social media about the various parts of grieving. I can't remember what they are now. It includes things like negotiation and anger and acceptance. That is garbage. That's not how it works at all, or certainly not in my experience. It's almost all these emotions happen at once. You can be angry and accepting at the same time, for instance. The real point is just how long it takes. I was told at the outset it would take 18 months. And, well, that's pretty much how long it took before it'd be sort of settled down to a particular level. At which I, well, not sound.
From then on, that's your attitude.
Yeah.
That's how you feel.
Yeah.
Yes. And you're always going to feel that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not kind of constantly banging at you when you're trying to do the washing up or something.
No, no. I mean, at first it was the only thing you could think of.
Yes.
Yeah, completely dominated.
Well, I remember saying to my goddaughter several times that if she were to die unexpectedly now, that would be my first really serious bereavement in my life. Because when my parents died, it wasn't a serious bereavement. It was simply life.
I thought your mother was in the 90s.
Oh, they were 90, both of them, you know.
Yeah. I mean, had they... I was going to say lost the marbles. There's a better the polite
way. They were good deaths. They knew they were going to die soon, and they died quite reasonably comfortably.
That's always nice. That's always nice.
How
far in advance were you sort of expecting them to die?
Well, when my mother died, my sister put her head round the door of the room where I was sleeping, and at once I knew what the news was going to be.
Right, but you were sleeping in the
were on death watch for my mother. We knew she was dying. The only question was when, and we hoped it would not be too painful or undignified, and we did our best. What can I say? So there was no.
Perhaps what I mean is, I mean, it sounds as if your mother could have died so a few years before she did. And you wouldn't have grieved then either. I mean, can you sort of
not
put
really?
No.
I mean, as soon as she started saying, "I'm so tired, my life is over," is effectively what she was saying. Not quite in those words, but I've had my life. You know, I've had a good life. And I think that generation, my mother was a mother during the Second World War, and she had plenty of contemporaries, including lots of male friends and. Her brother, who was shot dead at the age of 20 in a naval target practice, you know. So when she looks at her life, she's comparing her life with that. And by that standard, she's had a great life. And I think something of this attitude percolated to her children, certainly to me. And the proof was that when I finally got told, "You've got lung cancer," my reaction was, "Oh, well, it happens. There's a turn up for the book. What am I going to do now?" You know, I behaved like somebody whose house had been bombed during the Blitz. Well, that's a bloody nuisance, but these things happen.
Well, it's my experience of everyone I know who's seen their death coming has been similarly phlegmatic.
I'm not as unique as I wanted to think. Oh, dear.
Sorry. Well, I mean, Chris, for instance.
Yes, he was.
He was very phlegmatic. My mother was. At least one of my grandmothers was. An aunt who died last year. Yeah, I'm sure she'd like to have lived a bit longer, but she could see it. You know, she could see it was going to happen. So,
yeah, you face the facts, don't you?
Yeah. And people around them might lose it. That happens.
Yes.
But I think the dying. Well, maybe they're not. I don't know. But that's my experience. That's all I can say. Very good, Brian. You're being brave about this. No, you're not being brave. You're being Brian about this.
Brave is not quite the word. Brave is it's not bravery. It's just looking the facts in the face,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing I have to do about it. I don't have to pick up a weapon and start fighting against it. And all this talk about fighting cancer is all rather bogus, I think.
I don't know if you saw Jeremy Clarkson got COVID recently, and he did a little video afterwards. He said, the newspaper says, "I've been fighting COVID. This is not true. What I've been doing is spending 4 days in bed, and then I got up again."
Yes, exactly, exactly. People talk about battling cancer or battling schizophrenia or something. Maybe there's some truth in the second one, but there's not a hell of a lot of truth in the first. I suppose there are things I could be doing. First of all, I could study my condition in minute detail and discover all the things I could be doing better in the way of diet and exercise and things like that, but I wonder.
Yeah, I don't. No, I doubt that's going to help much.
Now, grieving. Have you said what you want to say.
Well, there was one other thing I was going to say. This may be a silly thing to say because it may make me look
like a
right nutter.
Well, I've said a number
of
very bizarre things in this conversation, so proceed.
Okay, well, there was a point when I was, you know, pretty miserable. This is almost a year into, maybe perhaps 9 months into after Mum died. And I actually just decided that she still existed and that she'd always be with me. I mean, this is all religious, mystical mumbo jumbo. And it sure as hell helped. And I could talk to any time I liked. And in some form, she existed. And it was terribly important. And that, yeah, it massively helped me. And
that's a very interesting observation. Yes.
It's not very rational and certainly would be frowned upon by many a libertarian, but it worked.
Not by me. I mean, I'm just fascinated by this. To me, the interesting thing is your own realization that you're not being reasonable and yet it still works. I mean, you knew at the time this was a somewhat odd way to behave.
Yes.
Didn't you?
Yes.
And yet you still did it and it still worked.
Yes.
I find that a very interesting. It's rather like, I remember I saw I was watching QI, and they had a bit about how it's very hard to describe. You need a picture. They had a relief sculpture of a face, which was made of a flat surface that had been molded into a shape. And when you looked at the front of it, you saw a face, of course, and sticking out at you. But when you looked at the back of it, you still saw the face sticking out, even though you knew it was actually going inwards.
Yeah, so there are
people
optical
listening
illusions.
Who don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But
I think I do.
The shape of it was one thing, and how you perceived it was the opposite.
I mean, you're talking
and
about
no
a jelly bone.
How
is that
hard
the sort
you
of
tried, you couldn't not see it the way you saw it.
Yeah.
Even though you knew that it was actually pointing away from you, and it's that, isn't it? It's the strange contrast between what you think and what you feel.
Is that true? I'm not sure it is.
Maybe that's
I mean,
not right.
This is a voluntary decision that I've made.
Well, there's a kind of way in which you literally can talk to your mother when she's dead. I mean, you can do that.
Yes.
So, yeah, I take it back. It's not the same as the face thing. It's not as irrational as that. It's a bit irrational, but only a bit. I mean, it's irrational if you think she can hear you, really do think that. But if all you're saying is you can say things, well, you're right, you can.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thought I had about death, have you finished, by the way? Is that list that you mentioned, have you?
I mean, there was one thing I was going to say. In these situations, it turns out you can't be miserable all the time. You just can't. Get on with your life. You could even sometimes smile and laugh when things are desperate like this. It's odd how that works.
Yes. Black humour sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes all this. You've got to be careful about making jokes.
Yes. Well, I told you about a joke I had to stop in mid-sentence, because I realised who I was talking to, you know. People who were absolutely trying to help me. And as I say, succeeding. And the last thing I should have been doing was to say they were causing all the trouble in the world. In other words, they were Nazis. That's what I had in mind. Because they were trying to help, you know. I'll tell you another thing. If do feel free to interrupt me, because it would only be justice. But it occurs to me, you know, I said that when I got my diagnosis, it was a speeding up of a process that was already well underway, namely me declining and dying. Well, what about a world in which medical science has rolled along for another few decades and human lifespans start to be seriously extended to the point where if you get clearly one of the ways that happens is that things like lung cancer are dealt with and conquered and rendered insignificant, you know, like polio or something, which has pretty much been sorted in this country, I believe. But what about if you die either because of a a rare but fatal disease or because of an accident at the age of 60 in a world where people can reasonably hope to live to be 250. That would be, that would change the attitude of everybody towards safety and,
yes, yes,
and medicine and well, what I'm going through now. If, imagine if I was losing another 100 years of life because of what I'm going through, instead of 15 rather dubiously enjoyable years of getting older and worse, you know. It would be completely different as an experience.
Would our attitude not be rather similar to a world war? Because a world war will kill a lot of people.
Yes.
Ridiculously young.
And I think one of the things that made the 20th century's world wars particularly hurtful was that this was a time when, if it hadn't been for the war, I mean, my Uncle John, who got killed in the naval target practice when he was 20, he would have lived to be 70, 80, 90. No question about it, if it hadn't been for the fact that he got killed in the war. In a stupid way that, it's the very stupidity of it that makes me keep talking about it, because it makes the point of what death in war is so often like. And whereas, in former times, a lot of the people who die at the age of 20 in a battle are people who had died when they were 40 of sheer exhaustion, slaving away in the fields.
Well, previous times, I see what you mean.
Long ago. I mean, it was only recently that the majority of people started to live to be 70 or 80.
Although the Bible talks about, was it 4 score and 10?
3 score and 10.
3 score and 10, right, okay.
70, I believe.
Seems
a good number.
Yeah.
And I've got past that already, and yet here I am fretting about the fact that I've got lung cancer, you know. But in a world where medicine had advanced hugely, it's going to be different, isn't it? Another suggestion for an article to link to from your notes, and I wrote about this at my personal blog, a piece by Steve Davis about the big changes that he foresees technologically. He was trying to cheer everybody up and saying, yeah, I know, COVID's very terrible, but there are some good things happening in the world. And he mentioned four of them. One of them was robot cars. That was one. There were two others, and there was medicine, things like the treatment I'm getting. You know, I talked about how the pills I'm taking didn't exist 10 years ago. That's the sort of thing he's talking about, and it's spectacular. Another one was artificial food. That was another one. Meat grown in the laboratory rather than grown by killing an animal. And I agree with him. I think that's going to be very big in its impact on what sort of world we live in.
Yeah.
And medicine. And he talked about it all as good news. But I think there's going to be there's going to be bad news in the form of how timid people are liable to become about dangers. If you think health and safety has got out of control, you ain't seen nothing yet. That's
indeed
Basically what I'm arguing.
Indeed. Although we've got to be careful. I mean, who, you know, who ever predicted the future the best? And when you read these things from the past.
Oh, yes. Flying cars.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember great... It's always transport, isn't it? I remember postcards from Russia, and everyone's going around in monorails.
Oh, yes. That's one of your life's great pleasures. It's one of your great memes, isn't it? The way that 100 years ago, everybody was hanging from a rod in the sky. Yes. Bizarre.
He might be right, he might be wrong. It's just so difficult to predict. About Francis Fukuyama writing after the Berlin Wall came down.
Democracy has won.
Yes. The end of history.
End of history. He didn't mean quite what most of us heard him to say, but he was being deliberately provocative.
Yeah.
And as soon as that book was published, history erupted and has been erupting ever since. Yes. I still think the basic thesis of the book was right, actually, rather unfashionably.
Well, okay.
I think that sort of mixed economy, liberal democracy has proved itself to be the best doable kind of society. I mean, as libertarians, we want something else, but I do sometimes wonder if it's possible, if humans are capable of that. Whereas I think they're perfectly capable of running, of turning every country on the planet into something like Denmark. I think that's a possibility. I think that's a reasonable thing to hope for. And I'm confident that this would be a very good, this would be a very great improvement over all the other places. And I also think there are a lot of people in each of these little despotisms scattered around the earth now whose boss is saying that democracy is decadent or whatever the hell they're saying about democracy. They would like their country to be like Denmark, and that their dictator is quite wrong when he says that democracy is decadent. What's decadent is the way he's doing things.
Maybe.
Well, if by decadent you just mean it's the wave of the future, who can say? But if by decadent you mean worse because of bad ways of thinking, it's self-indulgent moral posturing, you know, then he's the one who's decadent, I think.
Yeah.
I think Putin's decadent. He's reverting back lazily to a kind of czarist model of state power.
Although he still feels the need to hold elections, doesn't he?
Well, that's because he has to, isn't it? Yeah.
Why does he
have to? And that's the point Fukuyama's probably making, that even he has to pretend he's running a social democracy rather than a despotism. Yes. Yes, that makes Fukuyama's point for him, actually, if you think about it.
Do they have fake elections in China, I wonder?
I believe they do.
Ah, there we go.
Mm.
Yeah, they have to pretend.
Yes.
Which is weird, because no one thinks this is a real... No one's...
I'm not sure about that, actually. I'm not sure what Xi's answer... Is that what his name is? What his answer to the question is, do you have elections? Does he say yes and they're very good? Or does he say, no, they're a load of bollocks, we don't have them anymore?
I don't know.
I'm not sure what his
answer. That'll be one for the notes. I'll look that
yes,
up and see what
interesting
they're...
Interesting question.
Yeah.
How did we get onto that? It was something to do with Fukuyama.
Steve Davis, I think we were.
Yes, Steve Davis predicting the future. Well, for what he's worth, I think he's definitely right about two things. I think there will be robot cars. I think it's taking a lot longer and it's a lot harder to do, but I think it will happen. And second, and I also don't think many people know what these cars are going to look like and how they're going to be organised, but I think they will happen.
Well, I for a long time, yeah, I must confess, this is my sort of, you know, extremism coming to play, but for a long time I thought that, you know, robot cars were just around the corner. This is when I started. We started Transport Blog in 2002. And I think there was a moment... Was it last year or the year before when Google were going live in Phoenix, Arizona, with their cars, and I haven't heard a thing about it.
Yeah.
And it was a really, you know, it wasn't a sort of red-blooded, full-fat test they were conducting. And at that moment, I changed my mind on robot cars. I thought, clearly it's a lot harder than they thought.
Yes.
And I think they're just...
Well, my understanding is that all... I mean, we really are straying from the point now, but...
Well, can I just finish here?
Yes,
because you, for a long time, have been saying, we will not see robot cars. What we're going to see is robot trucks, because robot trucks will be driving along the highway.
Yeah.
And
also people are quite used to the idea that it's up to them to get out of the way of these things, because by their nature, they can't steer themselves very effectively around obstacles. So if you put an obstacle in their way, that obstacle is either going to get crushed or it's going to destroy the lorry, one or the other. But one way or another, there's going to be a very bad prang. And so therefore, there's a sort of basic continuity to the idea of a robot lorry, which is utterly lacking with a car buzzing about in a city.
And continuity, robot lorries will take advantage of the fact that people-driven lorries are dangerous.
They're already dangerous. You already have to keep out of their way. And it's no good saying, oh, but I was in the right. Fine, your car's still crushed and you're dead. Oh, we're back to death. Good. That's something. Yeah. So I do think robot lorries will be with us soon, and they'll be on motorways. That's where they'll flourish. And it'll happen sooner or later. But all transport systems are systems. Even electric scooters turn out to be systems. systems of where they can drive, how fast they can go. All these things have to be negotiated. And it's very hard. Robot cars are definitely a radical transformation of transport. And those take a bit of organizing. Whereas very slow trolleys that bumble along the pavement with oldies on top of them, with their shopping baskets, that's not a radical discontinuity, because that object is just a rather annoying pedestrian. That's all it is. And it fits in with the rules of pedestrians because it's going slow enough. But an electric bicycle or scooter traveling at 45 miles an hour is a revolutionary event, because the whole road system will have to be rearranged to accommodate that if it ever happens.
Yes, yes. Well, at least that's a subject where we'd agree that private roads would be a lot better, because they'll be more alive to the possibilities that they have, whereas the state has a tendency just to close things down that it doesn't like roller skating on the road, which roller skaters can be quite fast.
Yes.
But no, that's completely banned. So roller skating as a form of transport is pretty much
verboten.
Impossible. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Because it turns out it's revolutionary.
And I have this awful feeling this is going to happen with the electric scooter, sadly, because it does sound like a very useful form of transport.
Well, I'm fascinated by what happens to it when lockdown ends, if it ever does.
Well, yes.
Because that'll be the test. It's no good. I mean, I'm an electric scooter spotter at the moment. I try and photograph every kid that goes past on every young man. It's usually a young man goes by on an electric scooter, and there's a steady trickle of these people. But who knows what will be
almost
allowed.
Hit one today on my epic cycle ride. So yeah, they're certainly around. Right, are we done? Is there anything else you wanted to say?
Well, just one final thing to say is, this is not at all the conversation I expected we had.
No, not me either.
And people listening, I suppose we owe them an apology. We haven't really told them much about death and about what happens. But one of the things that happens is what I'm going through, which is you get yourself diagnosed with a fatal disease and then you get really superbly treated and you feel really good about it. I mean, it's bizarre, but it's partly just the sort of reaction to how bad I was feeling a month ago, and in a month's time I may be back to being down in the dumps, who knows. But at the moment it's extraordinarily good fun, considering what I'm supposed to be going through.
Well, yeah, with my mother, I mean the moment she was diagnosed, it was like a weight had been lifted off her shoulders.
Yes, that's right. At least you know what's happening.
Yeah. I think that was it. And also, she didn't have to try so hard.
Yes.
I don't know. Well, it sounds as if you have been having to try quite hard.
No. The point is, this contentment I feel comes perfectly naturally. There's one other thing worth mentioning, which is that when I was diagnosed, I had a. I'm not proud of this, but I am reporting how it felt. I felt as if I'd gone up in the world. I had a status that I had lacked before. I had this form of wisdom, which other people don't have, which is that I am looking at death in the face, and this gives me some sort of raised social position. When I got diagnosed, I bumped into a man who's, I don't want to give away any secrets, but he's got a very important job in London. He's an American. And up until that moment, I had treated him as way beyond me as a human being, just out of my league, This man understood things about London in great detail that I had no clue about, and I hesitated even to ask him about these things because it would be bothering him or something. I was starstruck by him. But then I met him again after I'd been diagnosed with lung cancer, and it was almost as if he was starstruck by me. Good God, I'm talking to somebody who's about to die, goodness me. It was a very odd sort of role reversal. Not reversal. I felt like I was more like his equal, is what I felt. But the idea that you're sort of socially promoted when you get diagnosed with with an illness like mine. It's strange, but it's a fact. This is something you don't hear from people who've been told they're about to die, but it's true. I mean, I'll give you another example. I was standing in my front room with two of my closest friends, and I was doing what I always do. I was interrupting. Now, normally when I interrupt, they either very grudgingly put up with it, or they don't let it. They just say, "Shut up! I haven't finished what I'm saying. Cut it out, Brian. Listen to what I'm saying," which I think maybe you should do a bit more sometimes. But this time, one of them held up his hand like a traffic cop and signaled to the other friend, "Be silent. Brian is speaking." It was as if I was the king or something. And that was because I was dying and I had special privileges to say what I wanted to say, and other people had the duty to listen.
Yeah.
And now I think I have lost a bit of status because I'm getting better.
Oh.
Which I have to live with. It's up to me to accept that as the price I pay for feeling better. And as death comes closer, as it will again, quite soon, my privileges will cut in again. But the idea that if you're somebody who's always wanted to be a rather bigger cheese than he actually is, which is definitely me, the idea that death might actually confer some advantages on you, or impending death, is perhaps a little bit surprising, but it's the truth. In my case, that is what happened.
Yeah. Well, I can certainly believe that. Yeah, we don't want to admit things like that, but yeah, I can see why that might be. I mean, as your friend, well, didn't say, but indicated, and of course, the thing is, we want to hear your words while we still can.
Well, that's like a promotion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas before it was, oh, that's Brian ranting on, you know, oh, well, plenty of time to work out what he thinks about things because he's going to be shouting at us for God knows how long again. Yeah. That's right. I'm done. Are you done?
I think I'm done, yes. Yeah, pretty much. Well, okay, we'll stop there then. That was by far the longest podcast we have ever recorded.